Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
Hey, I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and I not only do I host In the Drink, but I'm also the beverage director of a couple of restaurants down in New York. We have Dell'Anima, Lartuzzi, Lapicho, and a little wine bar called Anfora. I do want to give our Midnight Magnums program at Anfora a shout out. We're open until 2 a.m. from Monday through Saturday, and one on Sunday. And at any time after midnight, we have a great list of magnums that we just cut the price in half. Great way to share a delicious bottle of wine with some friends. For those of you who are tuning in live, I am sorry about the delayed start, but here we are. Thank you so much for being dedicated live listeners. It is a crummy day here in Brooklyn. It is gross outside, but what the view that I can see out of the Heritage Radio shipping container that we're sitting in is this actually really awesome. I've never mentioned this before, but I really admire what they do. They actually bring in a fireplace for like a couple months out of the year. It's like a temporary fireplace. When it is cold and gross outside, there is a wood-burning fireplace right in front of the studio. When it's nice, they just remove it and put a table, which is absolutely nuts. Anyway, enough about that. I'm excited to welcome back one of the only return guests we've ever had here, someone I consider a good friend and someone I look up to in the industry, a guy who brings a lot of fun and high-quality wine to people, both as the guy behind the wine lists at Pearl & Ash and Rebel. He has his own selection of wines that he imports, and he's the chef sommelier at La Palais. We have Patrick Capiello in the studio. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Joe. It's good to be here, even though it's such a crummy day.
You made it. I mean, I'm fondly thinking ahead to the bright, sunny weather in San Francisco in just a couple of weeks.
It's going to be exciting. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that as well.
So tell us what are you looking forward to, and how did you first get involved in La Palais?
Well, the La Palais event had just started right before I moved to New York. In 2000 was the first year that the event occurred, and it was at Montrachet, where Daniel Jonas was the wine director. And I started in 2001 at Tribeca Grill, so David Gordon would help Daniel with the Palais and kind of just by osmosis, I started to be involved in it as well. My role for many years was kind of just like everybody else's in the somm realm. You know, you just kind of go and work the gala dinner or the grand tasting, on and off with that, because my time at Veritas, Tim Kopeck would go and work that role, so I would have to work at the restaurant. But on and off, that was kind of just the normal procedure. And then David Gordon, who was really kind of just heading the sommelier team, I guess it's got to be 6 years ago now, because we were in San Francisco when he talked to Daniel about the fact that he was ready to kind of go into semi-retirement. Initially, it was going to be full-blown retirement, but now it's become semi-retirement. So David Gordon used to lead the SOM team and just decided he was ready to kind of not have to take on that responsibility, because the poly was getting bigger and bigger each year, so there's more and more roles. So I don't think it was as much about him. In retrospect, it wasn't about him being not interested in doing it anymore. I think that the job had just gotten so overwhelming, and really it needs to be a few people that do mm-hmm. the job. But at this point, really there's three of us outside of Daniel that do the job. David still is on hand assisting me, and then Risto Zazowski from Altamira Group is the other guy who helps, who's one of my very good friends. And so the three of us really are leading the SOM team now, because like I said, the events have spread from what originally was just a dinner into now several dinners, several tastings, So it's a week's worth of events, really. So it's pretty amazing.
Oh, so how many sommeliers were there in the beginning? How many are there now?
It probably was like 15 somms that were working those events. I think I've seen pictures of like the first Palais when like Raj Parr was there and Tim Kopeck and Bernie Sun. And, you know, it was only a handful of people. There's only a handful of sommeliers back in 2000. Now, you know, you can throw a rock in New York City and you're going to hit a sommelier. They're everywhere. Now I manage over 100. Between all the events. So, yeah, which is...
From which... Like, how far do they go?
All over the world. Yeah. We have people now from Italy, from Sweden, from Denmark, from Japan. Sommeliers are... And it's amazing because, you know, to participate in the event, really, people are kind of flying on their own dime. So it's not like we're flying... You know, we don't have the ability or the money to fly in sommeliers from all over the world. But these are just people that are so passionate about wine and Burgundy and so excited about the event that they're willing to... pay for their own airfare, pay for their own accommodations, and fly wherever we're having the event in order just to be a part of it. So it's like a huge
honor for us. I mean, this is my fifth or sixth La Palais, and I'm hoping that that you guys don't realize that it's a big mistake to invite me one of these years, and that there's other people who know Burgundy way better than I do. But I certainly love Burgundy wines so much, and it's just been as a participating sommelier, just an incredible way to taste wines that I can't afford and that we could rarely even sell at our restaurants, to network with other great sommeliers, to network with winemakers, and to also network with guests who are real wine enthusiasts.
Totally. Well, I mean, I think, you know, the way we look at it with the people that, you know, we're excited to work with on these events, we want people who are passionate about wine. It isn't just about Burgundy. You don't have to be a Burgundy specialist to work the event. We want people who are passionate about wine, who are hardworking, and who are, you know, interested in providing great service. Because with Palais, you know, when you have this many sommeliers, you would expect, obviously, the great service. That would be the ideal situation.
Is it kind of like herding cats, though, with 100 sommeliers?
It often is, yeah. Herding several drunk cats by the end of the week. You know, people start off strong, but usually they start to fade with their ability to, you know, handle all the... It's a lot of wine. I mean, it's a lot of wine, and during the course of the grand tasting, or the gala dinner, you know, there's such amazing wine that these collectors, you know, save all year or years to open at this event. And then they want to share them. They want to share them with the sommeliers. They want to share them with the winemakers. They want to share them with the other guests. So inevitably, you wind up getting a glass in your hand. You know, it's like every couple minutes, like somebody's throwing another glass in your hand. And to have the, you know, ability to remember not to necessarily swallow all of it. You don't want to spit out something like amazing, like, you know, DRC from the 60s. Like, that's something you kind of want to taste. So to have the, you know, self-control, I think, to realize not to get too drunk, but it's part of the fun.
It's, you know, that we have the public events. I want to talk about that in a little bit. But there's some things that people don't see, that guests don't see, that are specifically for the sommeliers. And that's something that I always look forward to. There's a sommelier seminar and then a welcome dinner. This year, you guys have Jeremy Saitz from Domaine Dujac.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. I cannot be more excited about that.
It's, you know, if you look at the people who have done those seminars for the sommeliers, and it's super gracious because they bring wines from their cellars for the sommeliers. They take the time to sit in a room with us for an hour or two and talk about the wines and answer all the questions that we have. It's a huge educational opportunity. You know, it's like having the opportunity to go visit them in their cellar, but not having to do it. It's here in New York or in San Francisco. But in 2002, I think it was the sommelier seminar was Aubert de Villene from DRC and Anne-Claude Leflevre from Domaine Leflevre. So it's like, that was my first introduction to the sommelier seminars. And I mean, you know, that's a pretty high point. And there have been, I mean, Christophe Rumier, you know, has done one or several, Dominique Lafon, you know, the Meunier-Gibourg sisters, Charles Van Kenneck from Udel & Nolat. I mean, the list of sommeliers that have, or winemakers that have done the sommelier seminar, it's great. And it's so exciting to have Jeremy doing it. I mean, he's such an amazing, you know, passionate individual and so dynamic in his personality. And I think that people are going to, the sommeliers are really going to learn a lot from it.
It's so. One of the few, like one of the ways that we can really just like learn with these wines that are pretty priceless. Those are so expensive.
100%. Yeah.
It's super exciting.
And often you see older bottles being opened at that event, which is really exciting. Hopefully Jeremy's bringing some older bottles of Col de Roche. I don't know if he's listening right now. But no, it's that's kind of like our way to try and say thank you, you know, for all the hard work. And I think it's a pretty cool way to do it.
I'm not sure if you know the answer to this off the top of your head, but are there tickets left for?
There are for I believe the grand tasting and also for the gala dinner, which is the big, you know, the big crescendo event that happens on Saturday night. It's the big BYO, you know, Daniel Balut is cooking, Michael Mina is cooking. It's a, you know, all-star chef lineup, 50 of the country's best sommeliers serving wines. Well, the winemakers are there and they bring wines from their cellars to serve the guests as well. So it's really an amazing like opportunity. It's the inspiration for the event. La Palais de Meursault is an event that has occurred for, I was just there this year. I think it was the 91st or 92nd Palais de Meursault. And this event that Daniel went to when he was young and traveling in Burgundy and first starting out in the import game. And it really affected him. And he wanted to transport that experience to the U.S. So this was the idea behind this dinner. And at that dinner in Meursault, it's the same thing. You bring wines, and the winemakers bring wines. And it's it's an amazing experience. I've been twice now. Like, you'll be sitting in your chair, and, you know, Jean-Francois Coche, you know, Cocherie comes over, like, with a magnum of Corton Charlemagne, you know, from the 90s, and he's, like, pouring you a glass, and, you know, it's one after another. Dominique Lafon with Old Bot, you know, it's in Meursault, so it's all these Meursault producers. But Daniel took that experience and made it for all of Burgundy. So this Palais is about the whole region. And, you know, we've expanded it. I think for a while, I think that the events tended to be focused more on these super rare dinners. And, you know, if you look at these dinners that we do, like this time we're doing a dinner with Mounier and Rouleau. We're doing a dinner with Dujac and Lafon. Really great Burgundy producers. And these producers are reaching into their cellars, which they don't have a lot of these old wines. Mm-hmm. And they're almost priceless in some ways. So these events tend to be events that are on the little bit pricier side, or they have over the course of time. But because those bottles are so rare and so unique, and we're doing them at, you know, super fine dining restaurants, I think that we wanted to try and add some more affordable things into the package for the Palais. And that was when we started what has now become the off-the-grid tasting. So the idea here is, you know, Daniel has expressed a desire to really connect with the next generation of wine drinkers. And as Burgundy has become rare and maybe in some people's eyes expensive, the ability for people who are young and interested in wine maybe hasn't been there to access these wines. So this off-the-grid tasting, which we're also doing in San Francisco, which started out, I think, 5 or 6 years ago we started it. It's basically under $100, and it's an opportunity to do a walk-around tasting with some of the great wines that you would find outside of the center of Burgundy. So outside of the Côte d'Or, that we have a lot of wines from the Mâconnais and from Beaujolais and from Chablis. And there's really what we consider the great values of Burgundy. And it's all curated by young sommeliers who are passionate about these areas, and they curate the wines themselves. And they're there to talk to you about the wines and give you a little education.
Yeah. I did that last year as a sommelier pouring in. I had the Côte Chalonnaise.
Right.
And you see, like, great winemakers who have kind of more prestigious vineyards, also kind of working in these kind of lesser respected, lesser known, but bringing similar passion. Aubert de Villaine has vines in the Côte Chalonnaise, Lafon in Mâconnais.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really exciting and a really fun time.
Yeah, it's a cool thing, and we're really excited to have that as part of it. We're actually talking about, when we're back in New York, maybe adding another event that hits mm-hmm. that price point, because we really do want to connect with the next generation. We don't want people to look at Burgundy as being something that's exotic and expensive and out of reach. We really want this event to connect with every generation, and, you know, I think that's always the key, you know, finding the ability to connect with many generations and not making this event be about one particular, you know, age group.
Yeah, and I feel like Beaujolais is like the gateway drug, right?
Yeah.
So every sommelier loves Beaujolais, and I think that it's because we love to drink it, and it's a good value. I think guests really like it too. It's just fun and approachable.
Totally. I think that the what's happened in Beaujolais is pretty amazing. Like, if you think about what those wines cost and what the interest level was, and even the accessibility, you know, you could find something like Foyard or LaPierre like on the shelf in any in whatever wine store. You know, like, it was something that wasn't difficult to get. It wasn't allocated for a wine buyer, and now that's the case. Like, these wines that we're really excited about, in 10 years ago, we would just drink in normal fat, normal capacity, have now become rare items as well. So, and then there's so much other stuff happening in Beaujolais. Lafarge is down there now making wine. So it's cool to see that that area has really blown up and taken off. And it's great wines.
I want to give a plug to the Grand Tasting too, because I think it's just an amazing event. And you have how many winemakers are going to be there?
It's 31 winemakers.
31 winemakers. I think they're each going to bring like three wines from the same vintage or so?
Yeah. For the Grand Tasting, it's 3 to 4 different wines from the same producer at each table. So every table you walk up to, you get to try 4 different wines with Jeremy Sess from Dujac. And he's there pouring the wines for you with a sommelier connected to that table.
So you're like 120 or so wines with the 31 winemakers and 31 sommeliers. I mean, that's it's an amazing event.
Unbelievable.
The level of coordination, I know that Daniel has like a whole team, but I can't even imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I think Levy Dalton once said it's like going on individual cellar tours with each one of these winemakers in that room. Like, it's an opportunity to visit Burgundy, but not to have to fly there. And I think that was kind of a cool, you know, kind of explanation of how it works, because that's really what it is. And you have, you know, the winemakers are willing to talk to you. It can be a little crazy, but there is interaction between the winemakers. You can ask whatever questions and they're totally going to answer. You know, that's why the sommeliers are there, so that they can deal with pouring the wines. But
I know this is crazy, but invariably every year, like, I'll get some guests who are like, I bought tickets to both sessions, because there's usually like an early session and a late one. Mm-hmm. Like, I just don't want to leave. Like, I bought tickets to both sessions, which is crazy, but it's awesome.
Yeah. By the end, people are like purple teeth stained and like a little bit hazy. I'm always like, go get a coffee, you know, maybe go take a nap before you come back for the gala dinner. Cause you know, that gala dinner can be also pretty rowdy. So
yeah. And I mean, the gala dinner for me, it just like embodies this idea of sharing wine, right? You hear it all the time that wine is meant to be shared. Mm-hmm. And the saddest scene in any like movie is when like in Sideways, he just drinks that great wine by himself. Like, it's just a miserable, you can't say, hey, how amazing is this? There at the gala dinner, everyone brings a bottle and everyone's sharing it. Mm-hmm. And your experience, you have this great experience with all these people at your table.
Yeah.
And the winemaker. I mean, how often do you get to sit at a table with a great winemaker who's brought, you know, multiple wines from their cellar?
It's amazing. Yeah, it really is amazing. I mean, I remember the first time that a regular guest of mine went to the Palais and wound up sitting next to Armand Rousseau. And he was like, this is like the most unbelievable experience of my life. This is Rousseau. This guy's like, his wines are an important part of my life, and he's hanging out with them all day. Jeez. You know, it's pretty amazing experience.
Do you have a favorite memory from previous Palais?
For me personally, I remember the first time, one of the early times that I was working, I guess it wasn't that long ago. David Gordon, before I was doing the assignments, David Gordon assigned me to Christophe Rumier's table. And, you know, it's always the busiest table. And, you know, when you get assigned to that table, you're like, oh, yes, I'm working with Rumier. That's such an honor. But it winds up being like a nightmare because everybody wants to drink the wine. So I'm just like, you know, pouring the wines like crazy. And David walks up and asks Christophe if everything is okay. He's like, yes, are you kidding me? Patrick's amazing. It's like he's got 6 arms. Basically he was just talking to everybody the whole time. So I had to keep pouring the wines to keep the line moving. So that was a pretty cool experience for me. But I mean, there's so many, you know, being able to like spend time with these winemakers and you know, late night after the events are all over is super fun. But I think, you know, It's a special event and a special week, and you know, there's so many great things about it.
And how do you feel about all these kind of other events that have come out that are modeled on the Palais, like the Festa di Barolo and the Riesling Fire and all of these?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great, it's an honor, I'm sure, for Daniel, and I think for the people who organize the event to see that people look at what we do and want to emulate it and want to create that experience for other wines. I mean, there's so many more wines than just Burgundy. So yeah, if this event works and if this event is exciting for clients to enjoy the wines from this region, why not let it expand to others like Riesling Fire and you know, the Barolo one. And there's so many that are happening now. So I think it's flattering. You know, I think that, that people are taking this model and moving it into other areas.
Yeah, I think it's exciting too. Mm-hmm. All right. On that note, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back more with Patrick Cappiello. All right. Hello, 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 hello.
The stars align to make you mine. Don't move too fast. Let it seep, the flavor deepens.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
All right, we're back with Patrick Capiello, the chef sommelier of La Palais, along with a whole great team over there. Also, the managing partner, wine guy at Pearl and Ash and Rebel. And actually, I should say, the newly Michelin-starred Rebel. So congratulations on that.
Thanks, yeah. Exciting.
Is that something you guys were even hoping for?
Of course, we were hoping for.
Is something you were thinking about? And
you know, I think... you know the timing when it comes to, I think if you've worked in a Michelin star restaurant and you're kind of, you have that understanding. I worked at Gilt, which was a Michelin star restaurant and it had been one of the first Michelin star restaurants when New York Michelin came out. So those guys in that restaurant, before I even started there, were really aware of how it worked, kind of like the ins and outs of the Michelin. And obviously you never know who the Michelin inspectors are, but they're like, it's funny. My girlfriend is a chef and we were watching this movie called Burnt, which I don't think was a very great movie, but it's about this idea of a Michelin star. And they talk about the tells for Michelin inspectors. They were ones on this thing that I didn't necessarily agree with, but we knew the timing. And that's the thing that matters. Most Michelin inspectors come over the summer. That tends to be their key time, and then they make their decision by, you know, the time October when the guide comes out. So when we opened the restaurant, our desire was to definitely get a Michelin star. We wanted to try and look at the model that had been started by some of these more casual places that had got into the Michelin guide in some way, like Lestrance was really the one that started it in Paris with a more kind of, you know, you don't have to wear a suit and a tie to go in there. The service is super stuffy. So we looked at that as kind of an inspiration, and, you know, we were hoping that that would happen. And then we slowly but surely started to feel like it might be happening. You know, there was some contact with Michelin. They wanted some photos from us. And once that kind of happened, we were like, oh shit, this might actually be happening. So I was away. I was actually in Bordeaux when it occurred, which was kind of a bummer. I wasn't able to celebrate with those guys, but I mean, we're so happy. We're so happy for Daniel. I mean, Daniel Whitey, who's the chef and my partner there. He worked at Spring in Paris for many years, so really had a great mentor in Daniel Rose in learning how to make, you know, really great French food, but with a more kind of, not modern approach, but I would say a more simplistic approach. But really, you know, it's an exciting time for us, and I think it's an exciting affirmation that we're doing things right.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you guys are doing just such a fantastic job. I've been a bunch of times now. The food is delicious. I mean, your wine list is insane. Like, I can't even picture. You must have you must be storing it in the sewers, like this whole underground.
No,
I don't even know. How you have that much room there? It's amazing.
I mean, what, you know, this restaurant we learned from Pearl and Ash. You know, I mean, I think the last time I was on it, it was right after Pearl and Ash had opened, and I think we spoke about growing the cellar there. That wine list is over 3,000 selections now at Pearl and Ash. And, you know, when we opened that place, we were working out of Eurocovs. Now I basically took over the entire, like, what was the dry storage and turned it into a wine cellar. I think because of my time at Veritas, where we had a huge wine list and a really small wine cellar, I learned the process of how you really optimize on space, mm-hmm. with the racking, with the inventory systems that we use, all that stuff. And it's all stuff that I've taught my staff. And they're able to execute it extraordinarily well. So in Rebel, we have a 2,000 bottle selection, a little over now. And between those two, you know, restaurants at Rebel, definitely I went in as soon as we started looking at the blueprints and I figured out where I was going to have my wine room right away. So there was an old walk-in that used to be this restaurant used to be the R Bar, which is just like a shitty dive bar. And they used to have a ton of beer on tap, but it was like Bud Light and Heineken. And, you know, it was a pretty crappy bar. Totally my kind of place. And so the keg room where they kept all the kegs, I rolled in. I was like, oh, this is perfect. I want this for the white wine room. So I converted what was the keg room, a huge walk-in cooler in the basement, into the white wine cellar. And it's rare. Usually most cellars in New York, if they do have a cellar, you have a cellar that you keep your red and white wine at like 55 degrees. And then you're working out of refrigerators for the white wines, like one bottle at a time. Usually that's how it is. But I'm like, and I've worked that way my entire life. At Veritas, we had a dedicated white wine room. pardon me, white wine room. So it really was something like, I want to have a white wine room that's dedicated and we can keep all the wine at the right temperature. So we grabbed that. And then I found another room that used to be the liquor room and it was really high ceilings. I'm like, and we converted that into the red wine cellar. So
that's great. Yeah. I mean, we definitely like, we have refrigerators and we keep two bottles, right? And then you have like, you grab one from the cellar and then you put it behind the other bottle. And so hopefully if, you know, by the time that second one, it's cold enough.
Yeah. Right. No, that we've everything. Yeah. Rebel is like pimped out with like, you know, every bottle of red wine, even the wine by the glass is all served at 58 degrees. All the white wines are served, you know, probably colder than most, than they should be, but it's better too cold than not cold enough. And at Pearl and Ash, you know, we work out of a red wine cellar and then we have some refrigerators. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's tight. I mean, it's an amazing thing. And I couldn't do it without with my very dedicated staff. Like, I definitely gave them the blueprint of how it worked, but they executed. They must have moved that cellar at Pearl and Ash 6 or 7 times because there were issues with us having to move it because of this or that. And you know, as time went on and the cellar accumulated, it's almost 10,000 bottles worth of wine in that cellar there. So it's a lot of wine to move around, but it's been set for the last few years. And
it's impressive. And as someone who like deals with wine inventories frequently and those logistics, it is extra impressive to know know what you're going through. Have you, I wanted to ask you this a little bit earlier. Have you noticed a big change since the Michelin star? Have you noticed more tourists and travelers and Europeans? Cause that's what I would imagine what would happen.
100%. Yeah. It's definitely, you know, you see people come in with a Michelin guide in their hand, and that was always the experience we had at Gilt. It's just, it puts you, it connects you with people that wouldn't otherwise not, you know, these aren't people that read the New York Times about or New York Magazine when they're going to go out to eat in New York. They're looking at the Michelin guide because it's like a guide that they're familiar with in Europe. This is something that they use when they're going to go anywhere, any restaurants. So it really does link you to an international clientele that maybe wouldn't be as savvy about where to eat or drink in New York. So it's an amazing thing. And it's definitely increased, you know, the business. And I would say also the type of clientele that we're working with now. You know, Europeans tend to really have a different way of dining and a different appreciation for food and wine.
Characterize that difference?
It's for me, it's always amazing to think most Europeans drink only wines from their country. So it's the one thing that's hard is that we get, you know, there's a lot of people that come from Spain because people from Spain love the Michelin guide. But at Rebel, we only have a US and French wine list. And so when they come in, they want to drink Spanish wine, which I think is so amazing that they're so patriotic that even when they're in another country, they want to drink, you know, like
that's Spanish amazing.
Wine. But it's a pretty typical thing for most Spaniards. And even the French, you know, I mean, they'll like you French people come in, they're never going to drink California wine, or not never, but it's rare. You know what I mean? The majority of clientele that come from those countries tend to stick to their own wines because it's what they know, which I understand they're comfortable with. That's one thing definitely. And I think their appreciation for, you know, like the quality of the food, I don't know, like the comments that they make, you can tell that they're the people that are well eaten. You know what I mean? They dine at a lot of great restaurants, and often they'll compare us to other Michelin star restaurants that they've been to. And it's an honor to hear that, you know, cause not everybody gets to experience all the great Michelin stars of Europe. And yeah, it's cool.
I mean, I feel like if I were to go to another country, I would pretty much only want to drink the wines of that country unless like they have something that's like super allocated, you know, like some French wine that we can't buy here.
Right.
Like, oh shit, like I'll buy that on the but I think it's so interesting when we see Europeans come here and they're like, wow, that is a wine of my country that we can't get because we only have like the local wines, especially winemakers say that. Like if you live in a wine region, you're pretty much only drinking the wines of that region. You might have like one guy who has a wine bar in town that has some international wines.
Right.
So that's probably also pretty exciting for them to see just like the breadth of French wines you have there all over the place.
No, it's often the case. So like, man, I can't even drink this much, you know, different wine from this producer and I'm from right outside of Burgundy. So yeah, that occurs a lot. People, there's always an excitement.
That's cool. So tell us what's going on at Pearl and Ash. You have a new chef.
We do. Yeah. Trey Bissor is the chef now. Trey comes to us from Colicchio and Sons. He was working for many years there. Alongside Ryan Millsnap, so who did a lot of wine events. So Trey really had has a great understanding for wine and food and how those play well together. You know, it was when we were looking to bring a new chef on. We wanted to try and find somebody that had that understanding. I think that was kind of always the thing that Pearl and Ash maybe was a little difficult for people because, you know, Richard's food is so polarizing and the wine list is also so polarizing, but I don't think they always matched up. And, you know, it was kind of that thing where this experience of Pearl and Ash came about almost haphazardly. Like, I was a consultant originally, and, you know, it just kind of all rolled as it went. And maybe the concept when we opened at Pearl and Ash was not that it was going to be an epically huge wine list and food that works alongside of it. So when we had the opportunity to find a new chef to come into the role, we really wanted to try and find somebody that had that understanding. And Trey's changed the menu. I mean, I think it's the menu is way more influenced by European cuisine. There's a lot more Spanish-influenced food, Italian-influenced food, French-influenced food, but definitely has a new American feel to it. It's not any one of those four things, but it's kind of all four of those things together. And, you know, the flavor profiles are really wine-friendly. I mean, we work on that a lot as we've done the wine dinners together, too. He's just a really exciting young guy to work with, and I think it's cool to see the change that's happened. So if you haven't been back in the last year or two, you should come back and check it out.
Definitely. And I've always loved Colicchio and Sons. It was a place that I brought like my wine team to because of the quality of their wine service, but also the food and how wine friendly it is. So that's exciting to see. I love your wine dinners. I'm on your mailing list. It's one of the few mailing lists I haven't unsubscribed from because it's so just always exciting to see what you have going on and the way you really dive deep into understanding specific wines in this really just like fun format. Mm-hmm. What do you have coming up next in terms of your wine dinners?
Those dinners are always kind of coming up as they come up. We've announced the last two, which is the one that's coming up next is Anjou. So kind of a weird little village in the Loire Valley where they make great Chenin Blanc and Cabernet Franc. We're announcing another one in a week from this next Tuesday. But I never want to give too much of a heads up as to what they are because those dinners sell out a matter of minutes. We're also doing winemaker dinners now at Rebel where we're actually having it's a little you know the Renegade Wine Dinners is always the idea was it was about fun and food and wine and it was not to be taken too seriously. We basically do those dinners at cost, and there's no big presentation. It's just like you getting the opportunity to experience the wines and kind of formulate your own opinion. Obviously, the staff that's there, my sommeliers, understand the wines and can answer any questions, but there's no big formal presentation. So when we decided the idea of doing wine dinners at Rebel, we wanted to do something that was a little bit more graduated in approach. So my thought was, why don't we just do exclusively winemaker dinners, almost in the same spirit of the Palais, where you have the winemaker in the room and they're speaking about the wines. So the dinners that we do at Rebel in the winemaker series, that's always the case. So we've done ones with Pax Mallet from Sonoma Coast. We've done Gideon Beanstalk from Closeron. Jean Bordy, a great Jura producer, with some wines back to the 40s for that dinner. This Sunday we have a dinner with Marcel Lapierre and Jean Foyard, two of the best producers in Beaujolais, and they'll be here for the event, which is pretty awesome. And we're
when is that?
That's Sunday. Sunday night.
Is that sold out already?
I'm pretty sure it's sold out. There may be a ticket or two left, but I'm pretty sure we sold that out pretty quickly. Yeah, obviously that's a pretty exciting one. So, but there'll be more of those coming up, and we're looking at doing some producers in Burgundy and other areas. There's a lot of stuff in the Rhone. There's a producer from the Rhone that we're pretty excited about that might be doing it.
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, you guys should definitely look out for that. I think that is all the time we have. It's always just such a pleasure to have you, Patrick. When you have more cool stuff going on, which I have no doubt you will. You always seem to be doing something exciting. You're always welcome on the show. Thank you so much for having me. And for those of you listening, thank you so much. If you happen to be in San Francisco or you are listening from San Francisco, I encourage you to pony up for the grand tasting. That's going to be just a great event. You'll see me there. You'll see a bunch of winemakers and sommeliers there. It's going to be awesome. Looking forward to La Palais. And don't forget to check out Rebel and Pearl and Ash. To awesome restaurants in New York Lower East Side. All right, thanks again for listening. Thanks to everyone at Heritage Radio Network. This has been In the Drink. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.